I want to be stereotyped. I want to be classified.
Welcome to Jughead's Basement Subcategory Lo-Fi Interviews with Hi-Fi Guests. Right now, you are listening to Descendants, Suburban Home. This is the second in a series of our four interviews I have conducted and will release consecutively with punks working in the fields of service to the common good. I have interviewed a punk doctor, teacher, police officer, and firefighter to learn and explore how they move about the world, what punk means to them, and what motivates them to help others. This episode focuses on my close friend, Mike Lamphere. Dr. Mike Lamphere was born in Chicago, Illinois, and spent his formative years in the pit at the Fireside Bowl, Metro, and various clubs in the Chicagoland area. While attending undergrad college, he was an active member of the scene in Carbondale, Illinois, where he played in the Riff Randalls as a member of the Lost Cross Music Co-op. In 2000, he moved to Denver and then Colorado Springs, where he is still an active member in the local music scene. He finished his PhD in 2012, and after 16 years of teaching English and film classes, has moved into a role as Dean of Students at an early college program. He currently is writing music for an upcoming project, as well as a piece on music and youth culture identity. So with my stereotypical key phrase, with no further ado, here is me and Mike via Skype already chatting.
I want to be stereotyped. I want to be classified.
Now I'm going
to
get this question that, TJ asked a fairly, not ambiguous, but sort of more general question. So I thought it might be a good one to start on that. So let me find her. But she sent it to me on Facebook, which makes it difficult to actually play. So I'm going to hold my iPhone up to the microphone.
And my refusal to use social media. But, you know, actually what's interesting is we're getting ready to turn that all over to the kids at the school.
Turn what all over?
Our kids are going to be running our social media for our school.
We'll get into that in a moment. Here we go. All right, let's see if this works.
Okay, so my question would be, how does coming from a punk rock background make you approach teaching differently than maybe your teachers did when you were younger? And is it hard to appear as an authoritative figure when you've probably been under the idea of going against authority?
Hey, good question. Okay, first of all, I think, you know, one of the things that really strikes my mind is that you look at how kids identify as brilliant and you look at that a little differently, you know, and you look beyond the standardized test. And like I was telling you about my poet kid, Shane, and he would love it if I gave him a shout out. I know he's signed to Def Jam Records now and he's a slam poet. And I will never forget sophomore year. He's in 10th grade. He's taken this vocab test for me. Kid defines rectify to cleanse the anus. And I tell that story all the time, and I about fell out of my chair when I heard it, because, you know, I'm looking at this kid and I'm going, okay, wrong answer, but he's brilliant, because for him to off the cuff kind of figure that out, sort that out, and use it as an answer. And it told me that I've got to spend some time with this kid. I've got to mentor him. I've got to develop him. And it really showed me that he's got something to bring to the classroom. And I'm going to say my instincts were correct. I mean, he's now signed to Def Jam. He was a famous slam poet. He's all over YouTube, stuff like that. And he's doing wonderful things.
All right. So coming out of the question that TJ just asked about that, how do you think – do you think you handled it differently than someone who may not have had punk rock would have handled it?
I think punk rock counterculture background, they respond differently, because your traditional teacher would have written that kid up or just given him a zero on the test or whatever and said, you know, hey, this kid's an idiot. And that's not the case. You know, this is a kid that standardized tests weren't really measuring his intelligence. And it was one of those things that really just, you know, gets you going here. And hold on a second. I got a dog rolling.
No, I just heard him.
Yeah. Hey, go on. Go do that. That's somewhere else. Go on. Yeah. He's decided now is the time he's going to roll around. So what I was saying is you look at kids differently. You look for those reasons to find something brilliant in them that most traditional educators wouldn't find. And you know, I could support that by even, you know, I mean, I've been interviewing for years for different admin positions, and that's been an answer to what I tell people is like, look, you look outside the box, you look for kids to develop brilliance in their own way. A standardized test doesn't always measure that. You know, and there's so much pressure on a standardized test, and the kids have to do well, and teachers are held accountable. But at the same time, you got this kid who, he's reaching out to you. He's got a sense of humor. He's going to get at you a little bit and see how you're going to react. I mean, this is a kid that I grabbed him then, and he was like a graffiti tagger skateboard kid, right? And I ended up taking him under my wing and working with him, set up an opportunity for him to graffiti tag the inside of the school. They wanted to do a mural, and I'm like, hey, I'm going to get Shane in on this. So we had photos of him in a mask and spray paint, and he's tagging the school and, you know, trying to help him find ways to fit in and help him find ways to demonstrate his brilliance and contribute to the class. And when you look at diversity brings, you know, the beautiful thing about diversity is that we get to see different perspectives. And I know you have talked about like your Facebook, and you don't delete those people that disagree with you, because you realize that diversity brings a richness to your life. Having a kid like that brings richness to the classroom. His perspective on things is totally different. I mean, I had a young man last year, I'm teaching Catch 22. You familiar with the novel?
Yes, I am. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. It's very rigorous, okay, especially for juniors in high school. And this kid's sitting in my class, and he's listening to his headphones and reading. Cool. All right, you do your thing, man. That's great. I need to listen to music. It works. And realizing that he's actually rapping Lil Wayne lyrics while he's reading the book. And, you know, as a teacher, your first instinct, well, that's dumb. Why would you do that? You know, you're not paying attention to the book. But you talk to him, and he sits in a Socratic seminar, and he can tell you all about Catch 22. So then looking at him and going, damn, how do you do that? How can you sit and read a complex novel like Catch 22 and sit and rap Lil Wayne lyrics while you're doing it?
So do you think you're I don't always want to bring back to punk, because I also want to talk about what in you makes you want to be a teacher besides imparting knowledge. But do you think that your view on life, and whether punk brought that to you or you discovered that you already had that and then found punk, are you more open to the changes in society and how generations are changing? Because I could see how a lot of people in the old school would have said, oh, that guy's not... this guy's not listening, he's not studying, but you are able to sort of transcend that. And I think you have to do that as a teacher, I would imagine, in general. But I don't think it's always easy.
Well, I'll be honest with you, I was miserable in high school. Hated it. Most of us did. You know, we didn't feel like we fit in. We didn't feel like we belonged. And, you know, I approach that. You know, when I talk to kids, I approach that idea that, you know, hey, this kid's going through some stuff, and whatever seems trivial to us might be monumental to them. And you have to kind of back up and go, okay, whatever that kid had going on at that moment is the massive thing in their life. And as an adult of 40 some years old, I look back and go, okay, well, that's not really that big deal. But it's not my point to say that to them. It's my point to approach them with empathy and say, hey, you know what? I didn't fit in either, and I understand that. We're all a little weird, and that's okay. You know, and you approach that with kids, and you approach them about teaching them to think for themselves, understanding where they're coming from. You know, I always go back to that Tim Armstrong quote, punk will always exist as long as a kid has problems and a guitar. And it's such a concise but brilliant thing to say. But at the same time, you know, you look at the idea that punk, the definition of what it is, has to shift. Okay. And in you think about, you know, being in a high school for, shoot, I've been in education for 18 years. And watching the kids change and stuff like that. And there comes a point where the things they're doing, John, we shouldn't understand them. We should go, okay, that's weird. It makes me a little uncomfortable, but at the same time, I can get it and appreciate it, but I don't really get it. And I ask kids all kinds of questions, and sometimes it makes them uncomfortable. Like I had one of my kids, he's rolling, and he's got the black gloves on and the Dickies pants and stuff, and it's like 90 degrees in my building. I'm like, what's up, man? Why are you wearing those gloves? And he's like, well, my hands are cold. I'm like, no, really, why are you wearing them? Is there a statement about it, or what are you trying to do? You know, what are you trying to tell me? And they get a little put off at that at first, because sometimes it's like, wow, why are you recognizing these things I do? But a lot of it is that curiosity in me to understand what kids are up to, what they're about. So I'm going to ask them, hey, why did you do that thing? Why did you say that? Why did you move to this slang? Because it's fascinating to me how that stuff grows. At 41 years old, I shouldn't understand everything they're doing. I should look and go, what the hell is that? Because if it's still the same kid in a leather jacket with a mohawk, what's really rebellious about it after so many years?
Yeah, exactly. From what you just said, I gleaned this idea on understanding of them, but I'm actually thinking of the opposite. Do you ever feel you're ever in conflict either with the students or other teachers on your approach to this sort of, I wouldn't just call it punk, but this think for yourself and putting a lot of the emphasis on the student almost teaching themselves? You're really smart and you impart a lot of knowledge, but I get the feeling you want them to do a lot of the work. Do you ever come in conflict with students or in teachers with that sort of approach?
Both, actually. And that's a really good point. My philosophy is the kids should work harder than I should. I look at it, I'm a facilitator of knowledge, okay? And I want them to ask questions. The worst thing in the world to look at it as a kid is a vessel to fill, okay? And we always had this idea that, you know, it was like an assembly line and, you know, everything's set on, you know, bells and whatnot. And we fill kids with knowledge and they move from classroom to classroom. It's my job to encourage them to ask questions. And the knowledge and the wisdom comes from that. And there is a difference between knowledge and wisdom. You know, you talk about, there's this guy Bloom, and he talks about Bloom's taxonomy and in cognitive development. Knowledge, knowing about something, is the lowest level of cognitive development. And it always blows my mind that people get so tripped out. Oh, he knows a lot of things. Great. What does he do with it? There's a difference. I can know my capitals, or I can know these theories, or I can recite facts. But at the end of the day, what can you actually do with them? Can you utilize them to create something different?
That reminds me of one of my favorite movies as a child. I don't know why I was so into this movie. It's probably because I had the instinct to be a teacher. But the movie, The Paper Chase, the original movie.
Okay.
Have you ever seen that?
Yeah.
But there is a college student in there who has photographic memory. And there's a point where he gets really frustrated because he can't really answer the questions in class, even though he has all the information. And I thought that was sort of an inspiring moment for me, where I understood that having all the knowledge, because I always thought my memory is not as good as it should be, I began to respect my abilities to turn things that I see into thoughts of my own. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. And when you look at how our society has shifted, why do we really need memorization? You can look anything up on your phone, right? You know, I mean, you can figure out whatever, but then it's, what do you do with that information? And when you talked about, you know, the conflicts with kids, I mean, I've had kids tell me, I hate you and I hate your class. Really? Why? And then one little girl, she told me, she goes, well, because you make me think about everything. I can't just watch a movie now. I got to analyze it in my brain, and it just kind of happens. And I'm asking my parents questions, and I've got all these crazy ideas. And she goes, I hate it. And I looked at her and said, you're welcome. And it was like, cool, I will take that. You want to call me names and you want to yell about that? The fact that I've got you asking questions and questioning what you see on the news and what you read in the newspaper, that's what I want. I want you to ask your own questions, because it is not my job to soapbox to you. It is not my job to give you some dogma or some belief system. It's my job to get you to ask questions and find your own answers. Mm-hmm. And that is punk rock. Okay. I mean, it doesn't matter what the answer is, as long as it's your answer to your question and figuring that out. And I've had that conflict with students as well, or excuse me, staff members as well. Sorry, it's been a long day. I've been chasing kids all day in the hall. Staff members as well, where I get in these arguments with them about the definition of rigor. And what does that mean? And, you know, I mean, this one young lady I taught with last year, she's like 30 now, she's a pup. She was one of those honors kids, real high performing. And I looked at her and she's killing herself doing all this work. And, you know, I asked her, I said, what's the difference between the regular kids and the honors kids in this assignment? She goes, well, they do more. And I said, so it's like the Spinal Tap of education. And she looked at me and goes, what? What's Spinal Tap? I'm like, oh, Jesus. Okay. It's one louder. It goes to 11. You know, I'm trying to explain it to her. She's not getting it. And I said, is it really rigorous if it's just more work? And you look at this idea of depth and how can you add to things and give depth and look at kids and figure out where they're at and find ways to expand what they're doing as opposed to just making them do more of the same thing. And it's that conflict I have with a lot of colleagues that, you know, fortunately the new school I'm at, they get that. And we're really about that rigor piece that comes from providing a depth to the work as opposed to just, oh, well, you're doing a lot of stuff. Because at what point does a lot of stuff become busy work?
Mike, you just mentioned your job now, so let's quickly, and you don't need to step and talk about each one, but let's go through your education into where you are now as a teacher.
Yeah, let's do that. Let's see. I grew up in Chicago. I'm a product of the Western Suburbs high school system. I did my undergrad down at SIU in Carbondale. We talk a little bit about that if you'd like. It's fun down there. The music scene's great. I did my master's degree and my PhD in education out here in Colorado. And like my master's was in curriculum instruction, which is in the theories of teaching, and my PhD was in ed leadership and policy analysis. So I've written a few papers and stuff like that. My main focus is school culture and achievement. So, and then I've been teaching for 18 years. This year, I recently moved into a dean of students position at an early colleges program, and it's phenomenal. The kids walk out of our high school with an associate's degree.
Mike, did you come into actually teaching later? If you're looking at the average of what age someone becomes a teacher.
I'm about average. I did a year in Denver and I was working for like a trucking company and stuff like that. And it just wasn't for me. Had some issues with some of the management in terms of like they would have you go out and like pick fights with people in order to discipline them and stuff like that. And I'm like, man, I just need these guys. They were union truck workers. And I just need them to do their job. I don't need to mess with them. It just wasn't for me. So I quit, ended up working construction for a little while and then went into my master's. So I went on my master's when I was about 23, 24, and then immediately went into the classroom.
So now let's parallel that with your leading into punk. I asked this to Bill Burnett, the police officer, and I thought it was interesting because there's maybe a little bit of a difference of when you hear the music and when you actually consider yourself becoming a punk. So I'm going to phrase it like that. When did you hear it and when did you become a punk? Or were you already a punk and then you heard it and then it acknowledged what you already knew about yourself? Give us a little history of that.
You know, I grew up in the 80s, Chicago suburbs, like many of us. And I just didn't fit in. And I remember every once in a while, you'd see like a kid in the hallway, especially in junior high with like a Ramones t-shirt on. It was kind of like, oh, what's that about? You know, didn't really know. I will admit the first album I ever bought was the Beastie Boys License to Ill and was super tripped out because, you know, it folded out and the airplane was crashed. And it was such a scandalous thing when I was a little kid, you know, oh my gosh, this airplane's crashed. And growing up in Chicago, I had a lot of friends that were into hip hop. You know, and it was just kind of you knew kids that were into it. You just knew it, you know, and I knew them, but it never really felt right for me. You know, I mean, I kind of knew some of it and was kind of on the fringe of that and just didn't get into it. Didn't feel like where I belonged and wasn't into the hair metal thing. I can honestly admit I was never like a big Metallica and it just wasn't for me. And I don't even know why. I mean, I was a kid and I was just kind of like, okay, that's fine. And I remember being in junior high and a friend handed me a bootleg copy of Two Things at Once. And I'm going to admit it was bootleg. Milo, please don't come after me for that. I've bought plenty of your plenty of your CDs and T-shirts and been to your concerts many times. But it was one of those, you know, kids copy stuff for each other. And, you know, I got this tape of a tape of a tape of Two Things at Once. And I remember like listening to the Wiener Schnitzel and stuff like that. And it kind of blew my mind. And it was like the same time that like Pump Up the Volume, stuff like that was kind of coming up. And it felt right. You know, I was one of those kids that didn't fit in with that regular crew. There was a couple of us and we'd sit and talk about music and stuff like that. And we'd hang out at the one little table in the cafeteria. And that's just kind of how I got into it. And growing up in Chicago during that time period was a really the 90s, late 80s, early 90s Chicago music scene was probably one of the best times in music. I mean, would you agree? You were obviously instrumental in that, pun intended, but I mean, you look at the bands and the things that were going on in Chicago during that time period, and it was just phenomenal. You know, so
yeah, there was a really strong period. I mean, it came out of the blue class worker of the steel mill stuff and the, you know, Naked Ray Gun and Articles of Faith and all that. And then it moved into the suburbs a little bit where Weasel and Sludgeworth and bands like that brought it back to the city. So yeah, it was pretty, and then it sort of linked up with the whole Lookout, which was happening on, you know, the West Coast. So yeah, it was definitely very exciting.
Oh yeah, when I was 16 and in high school, all I wanted to do was play at the Fireside Bowl and be in a band signed on Lookout Records. That was like my goal, you know. That's I'm going to be in a band, I'm going to sign to Lookout, and I'm going to play, you know. But I mean, you look at like Green Day was playing McGregor's in the early 90s. You guys were doing things, you know. You'd be on a subway or on an L train, and you're like, oh my gosh, there's Naked Ray Gun, you know. And going to the Vindictive store, that dummy room. You remember going down? Yeah, like it was like a pilgrimage into the city to go to the dummy room to buy a T-shirt and stuff. And it was tough because as a kid growing up, you didn't have access to the merch and stuff like that unless you were able to actually get to go to a show. So, you know, we did a lot of I can draw. So I've got a Sharpie marker and I'm going to draw a Screeching Weasel T-shirt or I'm going to draw this or that, you know, because we didn't have access to it. You know, you had to save your money and travel into the city to get it. And I don't think kids understand it now when you go to Hot Topic and buy what, you know, whatever uniform you want to wear. I mean,
or even just online, you don't even have to go anywhere anymore.
You get those mail order catalogs. Remember those? It was like sometimes in the back, you'd see all those band T-shirts and you tried to figure out what you were going to buy and stuff. And, but I mean, it wasn't that, you know, I mean, the alley even didn't the alley just close.
I think it did. I'm not too sure about that. I never was much on the alley.
But. No, but I remember being a kid. We'd go down there, Clark and Belmont, and hang out.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
By the donut shop, and then you'd go, you know, up the street to the metro or whatever. You know, I mean, that's what we did.
You hit on something that, once again, this is all sort of nonlinear, but I like interviews like that. There's a sort of passion that I'm constantly asking myself, and I'm trying to understand younger generations, and in that, you try to understand yourself and try to understand history. But I am really wondering that passion that I would think that comes into searching out something to, you know, going through all these avenues of trying to find something that inspires you is that, and since you deal with children, I really want to know is where do they find that now? Or, cause I feel it's integral to being a human.
They find it in different places. I mean, there was this amazing piece not too long ago on Dada and how internet memes are like a new form of Dada art. And they were analyzing that, and I brought it to my kids, and my kids were like, oh, yeah, the Tide Pod thing. That's not even, you know, you'd have to be an idiot to take one, but it's a funny gallows humor type thing that they like to do. And, you know, I bring that back into the classroom and have them look at their own culture, and it blows their minds. Oh, you read this thing? Yeah, I know what you guys are into. But they do. They organize, but it's the things they care about are different. Okay. And it is frustrating sometimes because I go to a show and there's like five people there and it's like, are you kidding? You know, why don't you guys go out? Why don't you guys, they do other things and they produce other things and they make electronic music and all these wonderful things that they're into. The school shooting in Florida. I mean, kids galvanized over this issue. And, you know, I'm going to tell you right now, you think that the new generation isn't mobile. The response that they gave to Florida, when you actually watch what they did and how they organized, if you're a politician, pay attention because those kids are voting in a few years. And many of them are like 16 right now and they're going to hit right at the next presidential election. And if you don't believe they're going to vote, you're sorely, sorely mistaken.
Yeah, I just saw on a show today where they interview a panel of pro-Trump people. I think it's CNN does this like every month or every couple of weeks or something. And I was watching a show that was about that show. And they had said that the younger woman on the panel is the only one that started questioning Trump. And they believed it had to do with the fact that the younger generation can actually just go online and search out these facts a little easier. And there's pros and cons of that because there's so much information out there now. You could probably convince yourself to believe anything. But there was a point to be made that as time goes by, earlier days, if you saw something on the news or in a book, you more likely assumed that it was true.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you still had to question like we try to push in punk rock. But I think now there's probably more questioning whether something is true or not. But it's also very now there's way more information out there to try to figure out.
Well, and
I don't
you
know
teach
if that's
them.
A question, but go ahead.
No, it's you teach them to be consumers of information. You teach them to triangulate data. You teach, you know, Twitter can be a cesspool, man. I mean, it is a cesspool of groupthink and this and that and the other. And I mean, it becomes some of the worst possible things you can imagine. So I play a game with my kids where I give them a world event and I make them go on to BBC, CNN, Fox News, and then Al Jazeera. And I say, okay, how did each one of these news agencies report on this event? And we analyze it and we break it down from things like the title to things like, you know, the facts, the words and stuff like that, teaching them how to triangulate. At the end of the day, we tend to start to find a new source we trust and we go to it. Cause I mean, let's be honest, with the amount of information out there, there's no way you're triangulating everything. Okay. You can't do that. It's just not possible, but it's like you find things you trust, but for bigger issues, like you're trying to decide on an election or how you're going to vote or what you're going to think about a real issue that's serious. You look at multiple sources, you kind of see what people are reporting, you look for the truth. You look for, you know, primary sources, those sorts of pieces of information, because it gives you a better sense of that. I think, do you remember not too long ago they had that riots over that shooting in Chicago, and that young man was carrying a weapon, right? And the chief of police in Chicago, I mean, he was right on. He's like, yeah, we just released the body cam footage. You watch it. You decide for yourself. If you think about how smart that was, hey, this is what the officer saw. You make a judgment on whether or not you think he was out of line. He just presented raw facts, and it was so powerful. Here it is. And you could see the guy going for his guns and stuff like that. And he had to look like he had clips on him or whatever, you know. And you notice it got real quiet after that. And he was smart. He's like, I'm not even going to comment on this. I'm just going to let you watch the film and you decide.
That's interesting you say that, Mike, because in these interviews, I'm sure they're going to line up in strange different ways. But Bill did talk, kept on coming back to that idea of the cameras on the mm-hmm. on the police officers. And his was all positive because he said it actually often showed more than not that the cops were right. Mm-hmm. But because of the way media is set up, we only get that other side, which does happen. We can't ignore it. But it doesn't set up, a truthful understanding of what the police go through.
This ties into what your friend's second question was about being an authority figure, you know, a punk rocker that does authority and stuff like that. And this idea that authority is about fairness and equity. And, you know, a good police officer is going to want a body cam. They're going to want one. Hey, you know what? You go out, you see what I'm doing, you know, and it's the same thing, though, that the media has lambasted these different professions for decades. Teachers are idiot. Cops are corrupt. I mean, how many times in the media do you see the Chief Wiggum stereotype or whatever it is, as opposed to, you know, I mean, even Mrs. Krabappel from The Simpsons, you know, you look at this, they lambast these institutions to the point where no one respects them. Okay. And then you're fighting for things like respect and, you know, you want to be treated as a professional and things. And the media is always going to focus on the negative in any one of these professions because it's easy. It's easy to focus on the negative. It's easy to say, hey, you know what? These people are messed up. We're going to point a finger, because it's easier to point fingers and place blame than it is to address real issues in our society.
Mike, this is the one time I'm going to acknowledge that we did have a prior conversation that I'm only using pieces from, if at all. This one's going much better, so I may not have to. But you did sort of introduce me to the phrase of fairness of authority, which I talked to Bill about, and he sort of showed me examples of that. So I actually wouldn't mind you telling me an actual real story of you as a teacher and what that means. The idea of fairness of authority.
Yeah, I could give a quick example. You know, if we got dress code things like hats in the hallway or something like that, kids can't wear hats. I know for a fact if I take one hat, I need to go to every single kid in that hallway and take their hat. Because the second I don't take one, that I'm immediately perceived as being unfair, unjust. You know, I'm not fair, I'm not consistent, and I'm not honest. Okay, and when you look at it that way, that's my job to portray that. In the classroom, it gets even more complicated, okay? Because sometimes fair isn't always equal. You get what I'm saying? Like,
I know exactly what you're saying, yeah.
Yeah, you know, I mean, certain kids need certain things to level the playing field, and you look at, like, how you approach them and working with them and things like that. I really try to build a lot of it in so everybody has kind of the same thing. So an example I have is I taught this, it's a research and writing class, and I always tell the kids, I'm like, look, you pick one topic, and I want you to geek out on it for a semester. It's whatever it is that you care about, whatever it is that you feel like you didn't get to learn in high school, you're going to take a semester and you're going to become an expert. So like I had this lady do one on, is hip-hop a vehicle for social change? Awesome, cool, go for it, you know? And they come up with their topics, and we research for a year, or semester, excuse me. And then at the end of the semester, they have a 20-page research paper due. I've scaffolded this all along, like built up support for them, like they've had an A-minus paper. Why do I give them an A-minus? Because it shows them how to get an A without giving a top end. My fear is if I give a kid a top end, they'll only go there. But if I give them a low A, it's like, okay, I can go as high as I want above this. You know, you don't want to limit, right? And we've gone through this paper and we've annotated it and we've talked about it and this and that and the other. So by the time the final draft is due, this 20-page paper, by the time that's right there, they should know this stuff. So we make a huge, 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 like, show out of the collection day. And I buy a massive, like, several boxes of donuts, and I sit up there at my computer, and the kids were in the lab, and it gives them time to work, and they can polish things up, but it's due at the bell. And they've known this since day one of that semester. I make them repeat it on the bell at this day in this class period. It is due. If it is not turned in, I'm walking out. And it's like, you know what, that's the way it is, you know, and I've told you all along, there's no excuses. I says, you know, you better be hospital sick. So I sit up there and I go through it, and each kid turns in their paper, and I sit with them for a minute and I flip through it, and I either tell them, hey, this is right or it's wrong, go fix it. Well, what do I need to, you should know by now, we've done this for a semester. I mean, we're talking 4 months worth of work here. You should know what's right and wrong, go fix it. They go back and they're printing it, and the kids are like, I sent this one. He'd come up. No, it's wrong. No, it's wrong. Everybody else is getting their donuts. This kid's starting to sweat. He's going, oh, man, I you know, it's wrong. Go fix it. It's fix it. And this kids are like, he's cussing you out at the computer. We can hear him. It's, I don't care. Fine, whatever. Fifth time he comes up, shows it to me. I flip through it. Okay, it's correct. I'll take it. So he grabs his donut, goes, sits down, and he's shooting me daggers from across the room. But later that day, he came up, shook my hand. He said, thank you. Thank you for having standards. And, you know, we get to this point where we coddle kids so much, we're not preparing them for the world. Because the reality is, if you miss your mortgage enough times, they're going to take your house. You don't make your car payment, they're going to take your car. Teaching them that you can have a goal, you can achieve it, you can plan, you can do what you need to do. But it's that treating those kids that way within confines. I get around the extended time thing with them because it's like, look, you've had all year. You know, we've worked on this a semester. You've had all this time to work on this. And we meet all along the way, and there's little due dates and stuff, but it builds up to that moment. But at the same time, they're seeing that I'm treating each of their kids fair, their peers. They see that, and it's important for them to see that. It's important for them to see that an authority figure can be fair, can be just. You know, they can come to me and ask for something and, you know, hey, look, this is what I'll do. I'll cut you a break on this, but not this, and here's why. And because the second you slide on one kid, they all talk. You know, and it's the same thing. The second that police officer takes a bribe or whatever, people find out, you know, and then you're not perceived as fair and you're not an authority figure anymore. And authority is that delicate balance. Okay, I'm going to hold you accountable, but I'm going to hold everyone else accountable, and I'm going to be fair and just, and I'm not going to play favorites.
I'm very interested in this idea of how generations have been affected by the internet. And like the industrial age, I feel like we are facing big change, like the generation, like we had agreed on last time, moving to the, I just forgot the word.
The singularity.
The singularity, the yes.
Yeah.
I do feel like our generations are facing more of a change in the generations that maybe other ones had looked at their kids differently. And I'm really interested in the positive and negative of that. And I don't know how much you want to go into it, but I know when I came to visit you, you were having a bit of a difficulty feeling that your knowledge wasn't being as imparted as a teacher as well as it used to be. Are you okay talking a little bit about that and what maybe resolutions you have thought about since then? Or how is that different from other generations you've taught or years you've taught?
Well, I think it was back in the day, I hate to, in my day, you know,
yeah,
18
yeah.
years ago when I started teaching, I could work with a regular junior class. I could teach Dante's Inferno. And I could full well expect to walk into my room one day and say, see, abandon all hope, ye who enter here, put above my door a notebook paper. Because those kids, you know, they get it, you know, and they're like, oh, okay, Lanfear's class is now the gates to hell. So they put that above there, and it was like, okay, so who's Virgil? You know, and we would have those jokes. And, you know, I think it's just having to shift the curriculum. Not the standards, because standards and curriculum are mutually exclusive, but to change the things that I'm teaching in terms of the literature we read and things like that. So a couple of years ago, I swapped it out and started doing Fences by August Wilson and used that to start my semester. And I know as an actor and a playwright, you know August Wilson, and Fences is so powerful. But there comes a point where kids need to start reading things that looks like them and sounds like them. And I mean, you could spend all your time trying to cram things like Shakespeare and cram things like, Dante's Inferno down their throat, but they're not going to engage in it. But here's what happened is I started off with Fences, and all of a sudden I'm getting all this great feedback from kids, and kids are engaged, and kids are fighting to read the different characters and stuff like that. And you approach it differently and you change it, and we're talking about hubris and getting into this, and kids are understanding Troy. And I, we talked about pejorative words in there, in like the first line in Fences has the N-word in it, right? And to be able to step back and let kids wrestle with that. Because I mean, I work in a pretty diverse school. It's pretty evenly balanced in terms of race, which is interesting, especially in Colorado. And I never forget, I had this kid, he's one of my favorites. And he's probably, if he hears this, he'll be flattered that I tell this story. But he's a brilliant artist, and he, very concerned kid too, very, introspective. A lot of these kids, they really think about like and process their feelings and what they have going on. And he says, okay, he goes, I got picked to read Troy, and he goes, I noticed the N-word is in here a lot. And I says, yeah. I says, you can change it, put the guy or whatever, substitute it, because as a white person, you might not be comfortable with that. We were talking about it a little bit, and he talked to, and he goes, but yeah, as an artist though, I want to respect the words of August Wilson. He's like, August Wilson put that word in there for a reason, and I owe it to him to respect his art. And I feel like I should say it. And they had this huge discussion about it, and they were talking about whether or not it was appropriate for a white person to say the N-word. And these are these times as a teacher, you just step back and you kind of let it go and you kind of watch it happen. It's like when you're playing music and it gets really good and you just kind of let it unfold. You don't, oh shit, I was supposed to go to the bridge here. No, you just kind of let it manifest on its own. And they had this huge discussion about it. Like, if this white kid said it in the context of this play for the sake of the art, was he a racist? Because he's like, I don't want to be perceived as a racist. That's not who I am. I believe in equality. I believe in these things. And he goes, I understand that that word has power and it's a negative thing. And he goes, I understand it's not my word to say. But they had this huge discussion about it, and it was brilliant. I'm sitting and watching. And finally, they came to the conclusion. They're like, okay, well, because of the art, we're going to respect August Wilson, and you can say it, and we're going to agree that you're not a racist. And they decided it as a little community. And I'm like, okay, they're going to do their thing. So they went in, and this kid goes to read that first word. And when he got to it, it choked in his mouth. I could hear it just get stuck in his, it couldn't come out. And he looks at me and he goes, I can't. He goes, I can't. I hate that word. I can't say it. And we said, okay, so what did we learn here? And they kind of talked about it a little bit, and then they went on and started reading the play. So, I mean, you change how things are presented. You change the content a little bit. Kids deserve to read things that look like them, that sound like them, to understand that wisdom comes from different places. So intentionally seeking out diversity in my curriculum, I think, has really changed my ability to reach kids. Because it's like, yeah, they're not always going to read that Dante's Inferno, but you don't think they can't get the same ideas out of August Wilson?
That story, were there people of color in your class in that discussion?
Oh yeah, several.
And now my question after that is, this might sound naive, but is it difficult to try to not like, because you don't want to pinpoint them and say, well, you are that, so what's your opinion? But you do want them to speak up freely about that situation. Was that hard to handle in the moment?
No, because I cultivate a culture in my classroom based on respect. And it's like, look, we all got to be in here. We're all in here for the same reason, to get an education. So we're going to respect each other. We're all going to speak and speak our minds and realize that there's different viewpoints, and kids can do that. Okay, and it's so great. In fact, especially out in Colorado here, it's the Latino population is heavy. And in fact, I would say we're probably 33% Latino in our school, and it's pretty even blend between African American, Latino, Caucasian, and then real small percentage of Native American, Asian. And but kids these days are so into how they define themselves. And you just kind of learn how to respect them based on it. Especially, I mean, the school I worked at, they were the first in this region to get a transgender bathroom. And you learn to do a lot of that. Okay, what's your pronoun? Hey, are you he, she? What are you? I had one kid that always wanted to be called they. And cool, all right, fine, whatever. And it just makes it easier, because it's like, hey, I don't care what you want to be called. I don't care how you see yourself. I just care that you learn and that you contribute to my class.
This sort of moves me into, I had these lined up words that I would say to you and how they relate to you. And the one of the one of the ones I'm really interested in and we sort of touched on that, but how much do you think a teacher is in charge of teaching morality? It's so different from family to family, but I feel like teachers sort of have to deal with that, of imparting that knowledge to a child.
I hate to play the word game with you, but I would move away from teaching and use the word modeling morality, just because it's not for me to decide what's moral and what's not, but it's for me to model a level of respect and behavior in my classroom with how I interact with my kids.
Oh, that's interesting. Go ahead and explain that a little bit more.
Well, okay, like we were talking one day about the power of words, and this is one of my favorite stories ever because I got in a fight with my AP about it. This is back when I was in a classroom, and I did this lecture on words and how they have meanings and, you know, the impact that words have. And the culminating moment in that lecture, because we talk a lot about profanity and stuff like that, and I maintain that there's a difference between a kid that says shit in my classroom and a kid that says fuck you, you fucking fuck, to quote, you know, there's a difference between that, okay? When it just comes out versus when it's directed at somebody, you know, when it's designed to tear somebody down. And, you know, I say, hey, you know what, I don't care, because you'll be sitting in class and a kid will go, oh shit, and they'll all kind of cringe for a minute and look at you, scared little lemurs, you know, like, oh, you know, he's and it's like, all right, cool, yeah, go on, you know. But if a kid says fuck you or drops the N-word or, you know, any of that stuff, or uses the R-word, which we try to really avoid that, you know, then it's different because it's directed at a human being and it's designed to tear them down. So the culminating point in my lecture is I'm talking to kids, we're talking to power words, and I ask them, I say, how many I love yous does it take to erase one fuck you to your mom? And you let them kind of sit on that and you let it hang out there. And you kind of, you're like, huh, you know, it's the same thing, right? You think, finally kids come back and they're like, well, you can't erase that. You're right. Because once it's said, it can never be taken back. And you model that sense of morality with them, and you use questions and things to impart that and let them make their own decisions. They know for a fact, we'll get into it and the kids will trade insults with me because sometimes it's kind of fun, you know, but they know I'll throw it back at them, but there's a line I won't cross and I won't do anything that's designed to tear a kid. They will never see me tell a kid, fuck you. And there's a reason for that. You know, it's because that those kind of things are designed to tear people down and tear them apart. And you model that morality with them. Hey, I do these things, you know, and I mean, I've done things with them like, this is why I'm doing what I'm doing with you. And I'm going to explain it to you like adults so you can understand. And I went through like my SAT data with them one year and I broke it all out. Hey, I was gone the other day and I know you guys were worried about that, but this is what I was doing. Here's the data. This is what it means. So when we go to do these, you know, these skills for the SAT, I want you to know this is why we're doing them and this is why you're weak in these areas. We're going to fix it. You know, do I kind of tell them that, yeah, the test was designed back in the day for eugenics experts to prove racial superiority? Yeah, I do. Because it's like, hey, they designed this to make you feel bad about yourself, so I'm going to teach you how to beat it. Let's go. And the kids are like, yeah, all right, let's take it down. Because then they feel like they're taking down the man, which is fun. But, you know, like I said, for the most part, that's different, though, because when I do that with them with the SAT, that's opening up their future and allowing them to make choices. And, you know, telling kids that, you know, the greatest gift I can give you is to make choices with your life. And that's such a powerful thing. It's like, I don't care what you want to do. I'm not going to judge that, but I want to give you the freedom to make that choice. And I always tell them, I'm like, you see the dude my age working at Taco Bell? Does he look like he's having fun? They're like, no. I says, you're right. He's got like 15 saucy ass teenagers bugging him for shit. And all he wants to do is go home and drink. So I said, I don't want that for you, you know? And the kids are like, okay. I said, so every time you walk downtown, that is a warning. Get an education. And they're like, okay, you're right. You're right. I mean, the flip side of that, you look at the most successful people from Harvard dropped out. So, but I guess the argument there is they had the skill set to actually get into Harvard.
This is something that you had said reminded me of this. I had another question. I'll get back to it. But this one is, I've been listening to, I always listen to a lot of philosophy podcasts. And I was recently going through the sort of Plato and it's the earlier monologues and the dialogues, mm-hmm. and about the sophists. And it reminded me a lot of what I wasn't into in high school, but was interested in, was the debate team and how you sort of teach people to learn how to basically argue either side. And I'm really interested in what a teacher thinks is being taught there, and the idea of not a contrary idea, but a different idea of pursuing the truth. Does that make sense as a question?
Yeah, it does. But I mean, isn't that the nature of punk rock? Okay, I'm gonna piss you off just to piss you off, even if I agree with you. Okay, there was a little band called Screeching Weasel that wrote a song called "I Don't" or "I Want to Be a Homosexual" in relation to a song "I Want to Be" or yours was "I Want to Be a Homosexual," right? And you guys wrote it in relation to the "I Don't Want to Be a Homosexual." And I have, you know, it was a thing in the '80s of you guys jumping in and going, you know what, we're just going to take the opposite side just to piss you off. And it ended up being like I had a kid that was homosexual and I played it for him and it made him so happy to hear that. And he was like, oh my gosh, I can't believe. And I says, yeah, my buddy's band wrote this and it's really cool. And he's like, yeah, right on, you know, and it just made him feel so good to be recognized in that moment. And that's what it is it's a game, man. Why do you think so many punks go into like law and stuff like that? I mean, they like to argue, they like to take it, you know, I've known plenty that'll take the opposite side just to do it. You know, you'll sit in a room and argue with people. And, you know, I mean, why do you think punks wore fucking swastikas and shit like that in the 70s? It was just to piss people off, right? You know, we're going to react to this and we're going to wear this stuff. I mean, you got pictures of Susie in the Banshees and she's wearing a swastika and shit like that. I mean, it wasn't like they were Nazis. Remember, Joy Division got a lot of hell just for their album and their name title. You know, they're called Joy Division and everybody was so bent out of shape about it.
And then they went to New Order, which is like the same sort of slap in the face.
It's like, you know, we're going to take whatever you do and we're going to do the opposite just to irritate you.
Okay, Mike. Now, here's where I think I'm sort of analyzing me and Ben, because you say that about punk and maybe that's the thing I lack, because I don't walk through the world that way. I think I am probably a little bit of a contrarian.
Not like Ben, no.
But I think, I would actually say maybe this is the first time I ever thought this, but maybe he is the debater and I'm the seeker of truth.
There you go. I mean, it's Lennon and McCartney and punk rock. You know, I mean, that's exactly what it is. You know, you wrote great songs together. But that combines, though, because I remember you telling me about Science of Myth and why that was written. And next thing I know, I'm using that song in class, being like, oh, yeah, my buddy wrote this. It's about Hero with a Thousand Faces. Check it out.
All right. I wanted to step in here from the outside just to clarify a little bit about what me and Mike are talking about right now. Mike and I have been friends for a long time. He lives in Colorado Springs, and I would often go out and visit him, and we'd go on hikes. And we talked a lot about my band, Screeching Weasel. We talk a lot about psychology and philosophy, and we're even going to write a paper about creativity together. So what he's referring to here is, of course, the song Science of Myth, which is on the Screeching Weasel record, My Brain Hurts. I wanted to clarify here because it makes it sound like a little bit like I had written that song with Ben, but obviously Mike knew that he's referring to it being my band, but the song was written by Ben, but maybe based on discussions that Ben and I had because he was watching Joseph Campbell or reading Joseph Campbell then, and I was watching a series that Joseph Campbell had done on PBS. So I just wanted to let you know what that is. It was called The Power of Myth. Campbell's widest popular recognition followed his collaboration with Bill Moyers on the PBS series The Power of Myth, which was first broadcast in 1988, the year following Campbell's death. The series discusses mythological, religious, and psychological archetypes. A book, The Power of Myth, containing expanded transcripts of their conversations, was released shortly after the original broadcast. So that's what we're referring to here now. And Mike is actually referring to another book by Joseph Campbell, which was probably used within the context of the conversations he had for The Power of Myth. Thank you. Now back to the interview.
I always ask my kids, I'm like, what do you think it took to take a man's life work and distill it down into like a 2-minute and 30-second punk song? And kids are like, oh, shit, you know, and I'm like, yep, you're right. It's hard, you know, and that's the thing is people don't want to realize is that's why we talked about this. You shy away from political music because good political punk is real hard to write. First, you have to actually understand the issue. Like really understand it, not a Twitter understanding, but you actually have to get it and you have to, you know, really step inside that. And a lot of people don't do it well. I always, you know, I love Brendan Kelly. He's a good dear drinking buddy when he's in town. Gotten drunk with him a few times. But when he got on that, Jonathan Kozel was right. And he was talking about savage inequalities, which compared DuSable High School to New Trier. you know, and looking at the funding system in Illinois for schools, you know, it's based on neighborhoods and stuff like that. And out here in Colorado, it all comes from the state. And the thing we've learned out here is that, like, you know, passing things like mill levy overrides and that, it becomes really difficult. It's where we increase the tax base so we can fund the schools. And in Illinois, you know, you struggle to move to the best neighborhood you can so your kids can go to the best schools. Right. That's the game. Right. I want to get in, even if it's in a little ratty apartment. I want to live down a street from New Trier so my kid can have these opportunities. And, you know, I mean, really, the understanding is it's not about an achievement gap, which is what everybody yells about. I had this professor of mine, Dr. Ramirez, he wrote on the gap in the gap and how every group of kids, doesn't matter your race or whatever, there's still high achieving, low achieving, middle achieving kids. And there's this shift to looking at it as more of an opportunity gap. For example, I had a kid the other day, he got this internship and we're so excited for him because it's like, man, he's in the ProStart program and he's got this internship with this great business in town, but it's unpaid. And he's like, I can't do it. I can't take it. And if your first thing is, well, why would you not take this? It's amazing. You know, it's going to give you an opportunity that you never would have. Well, talking to him, find out, well, he doesn't have money for gas. So then it becomes a, I have to take this job at the commissary for $7 an hour because I can get money that way and I can put gas in my car now. And it's that penny wise, pound foolish philosophy, you know, but in his mind, he has to take care of his immediate needs. So that's when I'm swooping in going, okay, what can I do to close this opportunity gap for this kid? Because the truth is he's a great student, he's really bright, he's very capable, but because of his family's finances, he can't afford to take the internship that's going to break the cycle for him and potentially get him out into the world and get him into a really lucrative job. So then it's like, okay, I'm going to swoop in, I'm going to talk to some people, see what we can do about getting him gas cards and stuff like that. And we ended up putting some services in place to help him to take that internship so that he can go to the next level. And that's the thing, like I said, that you really, you look at is when you look at this stuff and you look at politics and all that, is understanding an issue and really taking the time to get into it as opposed to some cursory outside look in it. You know, I mean, I've worked in education for 18 years. I've got a PhD in it and I almost know what I'm talking about.
Mike, the things that you're saying play up this idea to me that I think teachers in many ways have such a, I don't know, there's a lot of weight of responsibility. It's one of those jobs you just don't go home and, you know, hang your coat up on the rack and forget about it. It's a 24-hour a day job. Does that ever weigh heavily on you, and how do you deal with that?
My first day teaching, I had this wonderful mentor. Her name was Barb Tony. She taught AP Psych at my first high school I worked at. And my first day as like a baby teacher, little baby Mike, never written a detention or anything in his life. And I roll up in there and she goes, look, son, and these are her exact words and I'll never forget it. She goes, I just want you to remember even Jesus lost one. And you go, oh shit. And you kind of let that soak in for a minute, you know, and there are days that just tear you up, that you deal with some of the most messed up stuff. And then you know, like my new job, you know, I had to deal with this issue and it was real stressful. And then all of a sudden I just kind of rolled back up in the cafeteria and I'm hanging out at lunch. And my principal looks at me, he goes, I know why you're here. He goes, that meeting sucked ass and you're here right now to regenerate yourself a little bit, put some energy back in. Yeah, I says, yeah. You know, and you get like that, you get these kids that just stay with you. I had a couple years ago, I taught this film class and, I ran it like a college master's class where they had these projects they worked on and things. We watched all this cool stuff. We're talking Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, Metropolis, Dr. Strangelove, and nothing more fun in the world than showing them Dr. Strangelove and then going back and asking them what the movie's about. And then when you tell them, oh, it's about war. No, it's about it. No. What's it really about? It's about sex. No, it's not yet. Yeah, it's watch the beginning again. You watch the airplanes copulating and they're like, ah, you know, yeah, see. But we're in that class, right? And they're doing their final project for the year, and I meet with the kids once a week. You know, hey, how you doing? Where are we at? You know, what can I help you with? Can I give you some research and kind of nudge them in directions? And I ask this little girl, I says, you good? And she's like, yeah. I says, you got any issues? And she looks at me, she goes, yeah, I'm addicted to heroin. Beautiful little, you know, 17-year-old kid, you know, gorgeous little kid. I'm just like, oh shit, you know. And your knee-jerk reaction is to try and save it, but then there's this wisdom involved with that. You can't fix every problem. So I looked at the rest of the kids in a class and said, you're all going to behave. I'm going to be back in 5 minutes. And I had a friend that was a guidance counselor, and I took the little lady to this woman, and I says, she needs help. And this friend of mine is an expert in addiction counseling, and it just happens to be part of her resume, you know. And I got her to this person. I'm like, she needs help. Can you please? And we kind of went into it and were able to get her in treatment and stuff. And like a couple of years later, I roll up at a drive-thru and she's working the drive-thru. Hey, do you remember me? I'm better now. And, you know, and I was like, oh, thank God, you know. But you carry some of those kids with you for forever. I mean, I've got like a shrine in my office of the things they've given me and drawn for me and written for me. And you keep that, you know, and you energize with that when they catch up to you. I always had a running gag with mine. They'd be like, hey, will you buy us a beer? I says, yeah, when you're 21, I'll meet you at a bar and we can get a beer. Well, you're not going to buy. No, because when you're 21, you'll be able to get into the bar. And if you want to track me down and meet me for a beer, we'll do that. And I've had kids do that. And it's really fun to sit down and kind of catch up with them on a little bit more of an adult level and see, you know, what they've done and where they're at. But yeah, man, there's ones you worry about every day. And you're like, man, I hope this kid is doing well. And I hope they're this and that. But, you know, it's having the wisdom to get them the services that they need and the ability, the connections to do that. I've got one right now. He's a Native American kid from Wisconsin who's homeless. And my buddy's the ombudsman for our district. And I called him up. I'm like, Alvin, I need all kinds of services for this kid. He's really bright. He's in my new school, which is all, like I said, these kids get an associate's degree in high school. So they're 2 years advanced. I'm like, his kid's so smart, but he's homeless and he can't get to class sometimes because the car won't or whatever, you know. I says, we need to surround him with things so we can get him to where he needs to be. And it goes back to that, what we talked about, what's fair and what's equitable. Okay, and it's about giving that kid what he needs to be successful. I'm not asking a teacher to change his grades. I'm not asking them to make it easier for him. I'm asking to get him to the starting line. You know what I'm saying? So I'm like contacting Title VII, which is Native American rights and stuff like that. And they do a lot with services for Native kids in our schools and contacting all these different organizations so that we can surround this kid just to get him to the starting line. It has nothing to do with helping him through school. You know, and a kid, you could tell the kid's kind of embarrassed by it. I says, look, man, I says, you do this, you go get a nice job and you come back and donate money back to the school. I says, you've done your part then. You're reciprocating now. You're giving back. But now is not your time to give back. Now is your time to take what you can so you can get to the starting line so you can do this thing. Because the opposite is if we let him drop out, he's going to continue to be homeless. He's going to be a drain on the system. He could end up in prison or any of these things. He could end up in the back of your buddy's police car. All because I dropped the ball with him in ninth grade. And that's the responsibility that's there, okay? You know, and I mean, I'm conservative in some things, but I'm also a big believer in that fair, you know, that providing things for kids to get them where they need to be, you know. And there is a difference between giving a kid that's homeless help to get to school and do what he needs to do as opposed to bending the rules or inflating a grade for a kid. Because that's bullshit, you know. I mean, it's insulting to the kid. It's insulting to the system.
Yeah, that goes back to your fairness of authority. I mean, like, yeah. And once you start showing little holes in your ethics about that, it just all goes out the window or out of the bucket, to keep my metaphor not mixed. Here is a question. It's about inspiration. And I just know from my experience from high school that the teachers that actually moved me forwards to being positive about what I want to do with my life weren't necessarily imparting knowledge, but were charismatic or inspiring in a way. And not every teacher can have that. Is that something you think about? Like, how do I not only not and give them knowledge, but inspire them by the way I live my own life?
It's part of that. It's part stand-up comedy. It's part all of those things. Dude, I got jokes rolling around in the back of my head that I keep, and I bust them out for kids, and they got to change a little bit with the time because you're listening to the kids. It is. It's really, you're part scholar, part stand-up comedian, part actor. I mean, I used to tell my kids, make like Rick Ross and hustle when they go to the bathroom, and you say stuff like, oh, you know, hey, I got to go to the bathroom. Cool. Be like a bomber pilot. Drop your load and leave. Don't loiter over the target. And they go, ah, you know, and they laugh and run. Out. My new one is this year, you're so ghetto, or your mama's so ghetto. If she was a transformer, they call her Ratchet, you know. And you hit these stupid jokes with them, and you get to know them on their level. And it's the relationship with them that is what really gets them coming back. And I would bet that the teachers that inspired you, pushed you forward, were the ones that you had a pretty good relationship with. and they probably held you accountable. Okay. And I think one of the things that we struggle with as educators is everybody wants to have a relationship with kids, but how do you do it correctly? I mean, I fought, you know, with this teacher in my old building, like back and forth, because she let kids walk all over her and she thought that was a relationship. She would like cook them pancake breakfasts and shit like that. And you, the running gag was, hey, I know where all the skippers are. They're down in so-and-so's room eating pancakes. And you'd roll in there and there's like 50 kids in there that didn't belong. They'd be hanging out just to get free food. And, you know, when do you say to them, hey, you know what, go to class? You know, I had one kid, his dad was screaming, well, you're a racist, you're a racist. I says, I'm making your kid go to class. What's racist about that? I want him to get an education so he can be everything he wants to be. I tell all my kids to go to class. It's because it's what's expected. If I was a racist, I would let him skip and get, you know, drop out and become nothing. You know, that's racism, man. Holding a kid accountable, making him go to class, holding them to a standard. No, that's what needs to happen. You know, you're better than this. I know you're better than this, and I expect more from you. I always tell them, I says, you know what? If I didn't expect anything from you, we'd color all day and I'd give you A's and we'd move on. But to have that kid to flip back to that where that kid says, you know what? I hate you because you make me question things. Cool. I'll take that. You know, that's where that, you know, that's punk rock. Cool. Fine. You know what? Yeah. I want you to say fuck you to everything that you listen and say, you know what? I don't believe you till I find proof. You know, good. Go for it. And that's the kind of thing you build that relationship. But you know what? She came to my class every day.
That's a really cool ending. But is there anything else? I'll say that this is the ending and I can mix edit other stuff in. But is there anything you feel we didn't go over this time that you think was important?
If I were to soapbox for a minute, education is about community, okay? And, you know, people getting behind schools, getting involved. If you're a parent and punker or whatever, you're listening to this podcast, the best thing you can do, read your kids. And when they're little, it doesn't matter what it is. You could sit down and read Maximum Rock and Roll to them when they're a little baby and they're still listening to you and you're pointing at the words as you're going and stuff like that. And that's great for them. They get older, get involved in the schools, man. Spend time in there, go in there, read the kids, volunteer your expertise. I mean, you did that, John. I mean, think about what we did with that play a couple years ago. You know, not only were you answering the questions for the kid, but you gave him the rights to your play so he could produce it, and you came out, you answered their questions, you told them stories, signed their posters, and so, I mean, that's getting involved with these kids. And the thing we don't realize is that the schools need tutors and need inspiring adults to come in and work with these kids on a voluntary basis. You know, if you're an engineer, an accountant, whatever, and you're badass at math, go in once a month, twice a month, tutor for kids, work with kids. It changes your perspective, because the reality is we're all going to end up in nursing homes and these kids are going to be running things. And do you want the kid that can't do math to try and figure out your pills? No. You know, you want the kid that's educated and that, you know, hey, I had a hand in this stuff, man. You want them to go, oh, Mr. John, I remember you. I'm going to make sure you get extra of what you need. You know, they're going to take care of you. You know, and that's the thing is, we don't own this planet. We're passing it on to the next generation and they're going to take over. And, you know, how we raise them, how we teach them, that is that they're stewards of what we've done. They're our legacy. Okay. And you look at it that way. That's punk rock, man. I'm teaching kids to ask questions, think for themselves, and then I'm sending them out in the world to change and fuck things up, man. And they're going to do it for the right reasons. And like I said, I go back to the Florida protests. Those kids stood behind something, and I watched kids stand on the sidewalk while people would either applaud them or flip them off. Hmm. And those kids cheered and, you know, all that stuff, and they handled it so well. They staged this massive walkout across the entire United States. They had signs, they had organization, all that stuff, and they handled themselves so well. And that tells me, you know, that we really do. We've got faith in this generation. They're just going to do things their way.
That's a great second ending.
There we go. All right.
Here we go. Success. I graduated from the school of no knocks. I graduated from the school of no knocks. Now I'm down on my knees, asking when will it stop? Thank you for listening to Jughead's Basement. You are now listening to The Copyrights with their song No Knocks. The Copyrights were involved in the Carbondale scene with Mike Lamphere, which we referred to in the interview. Jughead's Basement is a free podcast, so you have no obligation to donate money. But if you enjoy this consistently, please consider donating to our Patreon. A link to that will be in the text for the episode description. You can also make a one-time donation directly to our PayPal at jugheadsbasement@gmail.com. And for free, you can also write or leave a 5-star review at iTunes or share an episode on Facebook. Jughead's Basement works on a few podcasts at a time, and we are currently working on an episode for Washington State band Moral Crux and Chicago-based band Smoking Popes. I will also continue releasing weekly the remaining episodes for my lo-fi subgenre. I skipped the one I had said was up next due to editing priorities. So this time, next up will be my friend and punk rock Chicago cop, William Bernath. I would just like to thank you, listeners, and I want you all to take care of yourselves because yourselves are also connected to others. Goodbye for now. Thank you.